And we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. Gary comes from sober at the summit. This will be the second time he's told a story since I've been involved in this meeting. The first time, he did quite adequate, I have to say. He had his sponsor here that night, and I guess he gave Bill the night off tonight. He's getting his strength up for his 55th anniversary coming up in January, which Gary's going to be instrumental in helping that event come into fruition. Anyway, that's enough said by me. Please welcome Gary Neidhart.
Hi, everybody. I'm Gary Neidhart. I'm an alcoholic. Actually, sometimes my name is Where's Bill? You know? And I don't mind that. But as a matter of fact, he's down at Panama City visiting a longtime pigeon. And he spoke at Jekyll Island. I thought he was supposed to speak on Friday night. I always like to speak first and then spend the rest of the weekend having people tell him how great he is. But he had to be the spiritual speaker on Sunday morning, so I understand this time. And his friend Sam has a phone, and the phone, when you call it, it plays Amazing Grace. So he comes up to the podium and down to Jekyll Island with that phone in his breast pocket and had his friend Pigeon Sam call it right at the beginning of his talk. And so you hear Amazing Grace, and then he goes and he listens to it to make sure, get it close to the microphone so everybody can hear that bit about God. And he says, yes, God, I promise to be honest this time. And that's just how he decided to start off. He's Wild Bill from Lawrenceville. And, of course, we do have flyers out there for his birthday upcoming on Friday the 13th, would you believe. But that's when he'll be celebrating 55 years, along with another fellow who will be celebrating 55 years immediately after that, which is Tom Ivester. And if you know his story, that's a whale of a tale, and it's all true, from convict to warden, you know, and that's part of the reason why Sponsor Bill calls this Miracle Land USA. Now, in getting around to me, there's a podium at Clarkston. And on the front of it, that's where I came in really to start with. And in front of that podium, it says, Expect a Miracle. Now, bah humbug. I mean, good grief. In me coming in, I had such contempt for that. But that just goes along with the type of disease called a disease of perception. So if you're anything like me, over time, when you're here, you're going to find out when you came in, you're wrong about a good deal of stuff. I sure was. And I was sure wrong about anything having to do with Miracle Land USA, because I just was full of it. Now, little did I know that, you know, over a period of time, and that's why we have to come back one day at a time. But I'll give you an example. Now, I'm originally from Cleveland, Ohio. All right, and I moved to New England in 1978, and in 1992 I moved to Atlanta. Okay, as some people say, I have a Midwestern accent. I've never understood that, but I guess I do. How I could end up in Atlanta when at the same time, you see, in 1980. As it so turns out, my father made a visit to Atlanta, and none of us knew it, okay? Because he was and incidentally, part of the privilege of speaking on this day is it's my dad's 95th birthday, okay? And that's a good deal of symbolism for me. And what a privilege it is, because I'm going to tell part of his story as well. But he came down to a treatment center here to deal with his alcohol problem. And it turns out, we didn't know. He died in 1997. In 2002, when I'd been in the program for 5 years, we discovered letters that were written by my dad to my mother from that treatment center in 1980. And when I look at the return address is Peachford. Now, Peachford Hospital was founded by Conway Honor. Conway Honor was sponsored by Mickey Milner. And Mickey Milner was sponsored by Bill Root, still is to this day. Now, how I can go from Cleveland to New England to Atlanta and end up being sponsored by the fellow who was the grand sponsor of the fellow who founded the treatment center my father ended up in? What are the chances of that? Now, another example for me is that, you see, if I hadn't been sober in the program, it would have meant absolutely nothing. Okay? And one of the things is, if you're an alcoholic like me, see, part of our problem is I want what I want when I want it, and I want it right now. And, of course, what is the drink? It's the instant feel-good. It's the instant gratification. And I get pretty used to that. I mean, I didn't come into the program until 1997. Demographic, I'm 63. Okay. And I've had a lot of training in getting what I want or getting that feeling. And for me, it's not a lesson in what we learn so much here. It's a lesson in what we let go of. I like to refer to myself as a recovering butthead as well. And that's with one T. See, there's no pop with one T that you get with two. But when I come in, you know, I am so sure of certain things. But guess what? Those are the exact same things that will keep me drunk. You know? And, you know, to really the person that I want to address this to is the person who was just like me when I came in, because I can sure tell you this, I couldn't hear anything. With the way addiction was for me, the only thing I could sense, the only senses I had was that my body was screaming for the mood changers. That they were screaming for a drink. But of course, what had I been doing all those years? It was always me. How do I feel? And then once those mood changers were taken away, my body was screaming for the stuff. And my habits were such that I was just simply incapable of hearing anything. You know, but with speaker meetings like this, I really want to dedicate to that person who thinks right now that they can't hear anything. Because if you are, you're just like me. You know, and in other words, I was getting kicked out of the house. I basically had no place to live. I ended up in one of those motels that you rent by the week that's not too terribly far away from here. And I know what it's like to play a lot of ping pong in the basement here. I know what it's like to hang around when there's nothing else to do or no place else to go. Basically, I had burned all my bridges. But another thing is, you know, with that atmosphere of how it is when nobody cares. You know, what was the real truth of that? I'm the one that really was selfish and self-centered, and I was the one that didn't care. Okay, because I put my mood changers in front of everything, my wife, my job, everything. And that was the recognition, you know, as it says in our literature, that I had put myself in a position to be hurt. And I was hurting, and a hurting cowboy when I came in here. You know, but again, the thing is that victims don't have to do anything, you know, because everything's always been done to us. The best thing that we can do for ourselves here is start to take responsibility. And that's one of the lessons that I had to learn that it was my best thinking that got me here. You know, but again, it was all so geared around substances. And you talk about contempt prior to investigation. And when, you know, what does a doctor do? If he wants you to go away, he gives you a pill. I was always looking for something to ingest to change my mood. It's in the idea that what's the word spiritual mean? It sounds like a bunch of baloney to this alcoholic. Because again, the lesson was I wanted what I wanted, and I wanted it right now. You know, for me, as it so turns out, you know, I am a fourth generation. And I only know that through an accident when I took my daughter. I was sober at the time, and I took her up to a swim meet up in Nashville, Tennessee, up at Vanderbilt, and looked in the menu and the heat sheet, saw people with my last name, Neidhart. There aren't too many of those, actually. And son of a gun, there were two people there that were relatives of mine. And through that, I was able to get contact with a person who knew where all the bodies were buried with the Neidharts in Chicago. You see, alcoholics, we don't talk about things like that. Those people tried as well as they could, and I will not have you talking about them or judging them. That was the message that I got from my dad. Okay, so it was no information whatsoever. You know, which is more or less typical, often of alcoholics' homes. They're, you know, my sister came into Alcoholics Anonymous in 1978, so she celebrated 33 years. But there's a blank spot in our memory. And it has to do, you know, when my mother died in 2008, and we found my sister's report cards. Now, my dad happened to be president of the school board, but he also had a daughter that was 1 year missed 28 days of school, and another year missed 32 days of school, and he was tardy 13 times while he was president of the school board. Now, there were fights going on, and my bedroom was right up above the dining room. Now, little people, for good or for ill, I think are just little sponges. They will just absorb anything that happens to be around them. And I didn't know what at the time, but what I was absorbing was my family alcoholism. That feeling of difference, that feeling of tension. And it's of interest that I know, you know, if you have a kid that misses more than 10 days of school, this in Georgia, you know, that's when the parent no longer gets to sign the permission slip. And that's when there's going to be an intervention from somewhere. Okay, well, not back in Ohio in the mid 50s, but it's you know, one example I'll just tell you, and this is the honest good truth, is that during the middle of one fight, my brother and I, we were in bunk beds, we felt the house shake, and we were just convinced that was my dad, you know, putting his foot down, up with which he will not put. And what we the next day, what was that? That was a 4.2 earthquake in Ohio. Okay? But that was the type of power we gave gave my father. You know, and they say alcoholism runs from Park Avenue to a park bench. What we had was the Park Avenue variety. It's a alcoholism is an equal opportunity destroyer. It doesn't care. You know, how much money you got or whatever else or what your job is or anything else. And my mother used to say how she was a believer in the theory of compensating weaknesses, where you'd have a great strength, you'd have a great weakness. Okay. And I more or less believe that, because that in that way you can say that we're all equal. But, you know, where we had... and the fact of the matter is, though, is with our alcoholism, because nobody said anything about it, we didn't know what it was. It was the gorilla that was in the side or over there that you look at him, but no one wants to look at him. So again, it was we had no roadmap. But you know, I'm a creature of the 60s. Actually, I'm a late bloomer these days. It's not unusual with some of the kids that I end up meeting at the Gwinnett County Jail. You know, you get involved with their stories. It's not that unusual. They start drinking when they're 12, or you know, they go to the mom's and dad's medicine chest, get the OxyContin, which the folks will never miss, and off they go, start selling that, and that's how they start their story. And 12 years old is not unusual these days. But I didn't have my first drink till I went off to college, in 1966 at the tender age of 18, you know, but and I ended up on crutches twice because of drunks. One was because I fell on a beer bottle, drunk out of my mind, that was outside of a dormitory and cut my shin. The other one, I was drunk playing a game of charades, of all things, and jumped out of a chair and twisted my ankle off of the chair leg. It was really stupid stuff. And I would have ended up here a long time ago, except for when 1968 showed up, so did the returning Vietnam vets. And so did they with all of their substances, okay? And that's why I like to say that occasionally I still glow in the dark. Because it was strictly, you know, what do you got? You know, how much can I have and how long does it last? And that was love, peace, dope, Hare Krishna, waterbeds. That, I mean, that was, you know, we... I don't remember anything about what, you know, I went back from my 40th reunion in college and people were saying, like, what was your favorite class? What, you know, what, I couldn't remember the name of professors. I had no idea. You know, I had a movie appreciation class. I can remember that because we got stoned with the professor. But that was, what a waste of time it was. But selfishness and self-centeredness, I should have taken that money and just, you know, it was my dad's money. Good grief. But that's, again, selfishness and self-centered. We don't care. All about me. I'm a tornado. I couldn't care less, you know, and I have good reasons for doing what I'm doing. You know, but it so turns out that while I had been in Air Force ROTC for 2 years, with things getting to be what they were, I didn't want to be in the military anymore, but the military kind of liked me. You see, on December 2nd of 1969, there was a lottery. It's the only lottery I've ever won. It was the draft lottery. All right? And so they were going to come after me. Now, if you want to try to be an existentialist and basically protest the war on ethical and moral grounds, you know, forgive me for saying this in Alcoholics Anonymous, but a hit of acid every now and again really helps. You know, in other words, and that's what I was doing. I mean, I go back and look through these screwball journals that I wrote when I was high. Ridiculous. But anyway, that's what I was trying to get out of the Army, but to make a long story short, I was not very successful at that. And I was drafted into the United States Army on June 7th of 1971. And, of course, that was an abrupt removal of me from my mood changers. I didn't like that at all. So when the draft law, it turned out that it expired on June 30, so did I. I lasted 24 days and I hopped the fence. And through a very fortunate set of circumstances, one was the unconditional love of my family. I was turned around, and I ended up meeting a child psychologist in Dallas, Texas. I had to go get back to San Antonio in 30 days, and the child psychologist was a longtime family friend of my mother. And it just so turns out, he wrote me up as, and I got to read this ahead of his sending it off to the United States Army, is he wrote me up as a hetero-homo masturbative sexual schizoid. And then instructed me of how I was supposed to go back to the Army, and when you sit in a chair, I was supposed to make sure I rocked, you know. Whether you know it or not, that's one of the signs of schizophrenia. I also had I'm a recovering violin player as well, and I was also using that as a teddy bear, okay, and I couldn't be separated from it. The long story short is I was unsuitable for military service, and in 1971, that seemed to be a pretty good deal, you know, and, you know, if you're any of the Vietnam vets, I mean, and there are a number of them that are in this fellowship, I honor you. But it just, that was, you know, by that time, that war was 10 years old, you know, and I just wanted nothing to do with it, for good or for ill. But, you know, I got out and I could go right back to my mood changers in Ohio. I was until the mid-70s. I had this episode. You see, my even though we had short tempers, and we had a lot of consumption of alcohol. My father was not, could just simply down it in this drinking culture that he was part of. He'd never show anything. But all of a sudden, I mean, in the mid-70s, we had this episode where my mother had kidney stones. And you know, cutting through the back muscles, a heavy-duty operation. So my brother and I go off to the hospital after work to check on my mother, who's had these kidney stone operations, and we met my dad in the lobby of the hospital. And he comes up to us, and he tells us in so many words what a great woman my mother was, how we didn't appreciate her, that we didn't show her proper respect. And we get this first class harangue, you know. And we're sitting and absorbing this. And my brother goes over to the to the office or whatever to find out where my mother is. And you see, we find out there was no kidney stone operation. My mother had passed the stone, and my dad was too drunk to know it. And that was the first clue that something was seriously wrong. I don't know what it, what happened, but it went to where it seemed like the fellow could, where he just had a light switch go off, maybe with his liver or something else. And he, if he so much smelled the stuff, he was a mess. Okay, but I, you know, I ended up at that time, and I didn't know any better. Again, because he was a company president, I would do the things like, come to the rescue. There would be some well-known personality that would be speaking at the Council of Foreign Affairs in a mansion in Cleveland, and I would get a call, and I would say, we've got your father. He's in that bad way. Can you come and get him? And I wouldn't. Okay. But, you know, alcoholism is such where, you know, when there will be moments where the alcoholic can do some damage. And, you know, and one of them for me was coming up to my father, sitting at the ground across from him, and he looks at me through those eyes, and he goes, "Who are you, young man?" You know, there's certain things like that you can forgive, but you never forget. You know, and on both, these days, for whatever it's worth, I also find it supplemental for me and fundamental to do Al-Anon as well, because I'm dealing with a number of other tornadoes, as well as me being a tornado. That's just my own a choice at it. But I eventually ended up doing my geographic cure was to get out of the fire of my dad's alcoholism, and that's part of the reason why I went to New England. Now, and part of the reason also, though, I love sticking around this. I'm an archivist as well as for Alcoholics Anonymous, as well as working in corrections. You know, Mr. Bill and I have been in jail meetings together for 10 years. But it's one of those little coincidences. I move from Cleveland to Rhode Island, and I go to work for a company there, and my boss's boss's boss in that company was a fellow by the name of Chet Kirk, and I can use his first and last name because actually I'm naming a library that happens to be at Brown University. He happened to be a recovering alcoholic. And if you want to go see Bob and Ann Smith's coffee pot, you go to the Chet Kirk Library at Brown University in Rhode Island. How did it end up there? Sue Windows, Dr. Bob's daughter, ended up having that in possession, and she could have either given the stuff away or sold it. And she ended up selling it to Chet Kirk, and all of that stuff happens to be in Rhode Island now. But that, it just, to me, it's just one of the little bellwethers, little reminders about the way that I'm where I'm supposed to be. That I went to the one job I get that I moved 600 miles away, I'm moving towards Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, another thing, this is just one of those little things that when I go from Rhode Island to Boston, and I'm in the Boston area in 1981, And there's this bar. Well, it's a lovely federal building that's on Boston Garden. And it's a $10 cover charge on a Friday night to go in there. And I figured, well, you know, $10 to get in. And if a lady, maybe they're getting in for free. But it's a good place to meet women. So I go there, and that place turned out to be Cheers. Now, that's what that building you would see, you know, and that's where you would go, and where everybody knew your name. Well, I was actually an honest-to-goodness member there. At least I paid the $10 to go there, and nobody ever knew my name. That's part of the false promises of alcoholism. But I did, in 1983, through work, I met this lady, and she took an interest in me, and I took an interest in her, and so forth. We had one of those at-work romances. But on the subject of honesty, I've never had a whole lot of tact sometimes. That's incidentally why having a sponsor in this program is such a really good idea. You might want to try out things with your sponsor before you try them out on whoever it happens to be. You see, and I had this occasion where I'd been dating this lady for some time. And I made the announcement to her that I was going to be meeting a female in Honolulu, and it wasn't going to be her. But she didn't like that, you know, all that much. And so she took her drink and threw it, and it smashed against a wall. You know, and she just started screaming with me. Now, I don't like scenes. And so I'm trying to pick up the pieces, and she's yelling at me, and the management of the bar doesn't like this all this much. So they asked us to leave. You know, so sure, I'll leave. You know, and we go out the front door, and I can remember so well, we get out to they're standing on the sidewalk, and she cold ties me. And it's, and as soon as I go back, there's somebody that catches me, and that was the police. Okay, now we weren't really guilty of anything. They kind of took us away just for our own protection to have, and somebody had to come and pick us up. You know, but what do you do if you're an alcoholic like me with a woman like that after she's done what she's done? You marry her, of course you do. Okay? Which, yeah, you know, that's what you wanted, I thought, you know. And that was a marriage that lasted, 11 years. But with that as a starter, when it did blow up, I had to take responsibility for my part. I chose her. You know, and what was my criteria? She drank like I did. Okay. In other words, when we would go up to these ski clubs in North Conway, New Hampshire, and just drink ourselves silly. I mean, they have an ice bar, the Polecats up there in North Conway. In March, they build a bar out of ice. It might be 150 feet long, and they serve their drinks in the 5-gallon drums. Okay, and that is the pre-party that goes on from 4 to 7. The real parties start after that. Okay, and that's just the drinking culture that was all part of it. Of course, we'd have people show up there by the busload, for that. But nevertheless, through a variety of economic sets of circumstances, I moved from down from, actually I was in New Hampshire for 8 years and moved to Atlanta with a venture capital company in 1992. And, it was that venture capital experience lasted about 3 years until it entirely blew up. That put a good deal of pressure on us. And, of course, when you pick up roots, they don't necessarily transfer either. By then I've got three children, and the mood changers really don't work anymore. And another thing, I had a contract in 1997, which took me to London and got me entirely out of the way for three different times during that year. And my ex-wife got really kind of used to me not being around, quite frankly. By the August of 1997, she announced that she no longer wanted to be married. And she's a very forceful female, and she was going to get me out of that house in 1 month. And that's exactly what happened. But again, my part in that is I was entirely isolated. And in many regards, since the only work I had in London, there was no friendly direction to go. I had no one I could pick up and call and say, this is what's happening. You know, lots of times problems, it amplified so much. Why? Because we're left alone with them, and they can fester, and they can take on such power. And we're the ones that actually participate in giving them such power, especially when we don't reach out and ask for help. As the saying goes, there's no shame in asking for help. So often the only shame is not asking for help. Again, another reason why sponsorship is so absolutely essential. Again, remember, one of the best acronyms I think that exists in recovery is simply how I think. S-H-I-T. Okay, because it leads me into more trouble. So I started coming to Clarkston, into NABA, and if you're like me, not every Alcoholics Anonymous meeting is filled with what I need to hear. I'm a math major, so there's 720 squares up here and there's 33 rows of bricks over there. In case you were wondering, but again, that was part of me, again, not being able to listen to the message of recovery. So I just simply had to. It's so fundamental. The only thing to do is to keep coming back, but then also find somebody that might tell your story. I've got this little card here. In gratitude to Almighty God for the creation of Henrietta Buckler Cyberling, Ann Robertson Smith, Lois Burnham Wilson, Walter F. Tunks, and Alcoholics Anonymous. And what this is a little card that you get when you walk into this, what's known as the Cyberling Gatehouse. But it's really what it is. It's the Stan Hewitt Gatehouse where Henrietta Cyberling was renting, and that's where Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson met. Mr. Bill and I were up there in May. And you get in this little room, which is probably, I don't know, maybe it's 14 by 14. And they just have little benches, which you can go in there and sit. And that's the little room that got this whole thing started. And really what got the whole thing started was in one thing I happen to be mimicking tonight, storytelling. And it was Bill Wilson telling Dr. Bob that about himself, because after all, we don't respond very well to commands. We've probably been told what to do more times than most people on the face of the earth. Okay, and we blow it off or deny it or whatever, or tell somebody to go take a flying you-know-what-you-know-where or whatever. I mean, we kind of like herding cats. But at the same time, it's the key principle here is identification. The key principle here is, wait a minute, if I do what he did, I'll be better off. This is not a temperance society. This is not a goody-goody society. As far as I'm concerned, it just simply comes down to the fact that for me, it's really a bad idea for me to drink. There'll never be enough. And the lesson turns out to be no amount of happiness really comes from the consumption of anything in the end result. Where does the happiness come from? It comes from the givers. I think that actually it's remarkable transformation that takes place here. What I identified with was selfishness and self-centeredness. I could tap dance around the God business. Okay, I was a deacon in the church, and I went there stoned. Okay, and that was up in New Hampshire. All right, but I could tap dance around that, and you know, because God was always what I thought, you see, and it was only after being in this fellowship for some time. As a matter of fact, it took me 8 years. It took 8 years for the message of God to go from here to here. Okay, 15 inches, 8 years. But what am I talking about? It's Sandy Beach, I think, that came up with something that's brilliant for me. It's that if he had any words that he could change in any of our literature, it would be God as we experience him versus God as we understand him, because it's through the experience we understand. It so turns out that the way I first felt that was to meet I can remember going at the Gwinnett County Jail, and I met a father that was out in the waiting room, and I knew him from the program. And he said, "What are you doing here?" And he says, "My son's in there." Now, I met the son, and the son was in there for like 6 weeks. Then the son went off to a boot camp, and he was gone for maybe 18 months. Okay. And then I was at a meeting, the solution group out in Gwinnett, and I met the father and the son at the very same AA meeting, and both of them gave me attaboys. Now, in other words, thank you very much. Now, I know what a rush is, okay, from my 60s days, okay, and that was the first time I physically got a sensation of getting a rush without having to go to the dope man or ingesting any other substances. And see, that's an experience. That's a feeling. That has nothing to do with what's going on between my ears. But the fact of the matter was, see, I was so trapped in my own thoughts, it took me a long time to unlearn what I thought I knew. And this is, you know, Mr. Bill calls this a dumbed-down society. Maybe I'm too sensitive for that. But at minimum, it's an unlearning society, you know. And, you know, one of those little coincidences of, you know, this fellowship, as it so turns out, the son that was at the jail meeting that I went into, he's in the room tonight, okay. And I just love the quote-unquote coincidence and or the symbolism that goes with that. Mr. Bill will talk about this is a program that is filled with spiritual law. You know, we didn't originate anything, but you know, if you give, you get back. The difference is you don't know when, okay? But you will get back, and that's what I firmly believe, because that's my experience as well. We get back in all sorts of ways that we would never anticipate. Now, one of them would be, it was a nasty divorce and so forth, and in 2006, I had been actually for a number of years there was a ceremony that would go on a New Year's Eve by a lady that's she's a female pastor out in Gwinnett. You get to go to the fireplace and you have two pieces of paper, and one of the pieces of paper is you throw in the fire what you want to get rid of, and you take away with you a piece of paper of what you want to take with you. You know, it sounds a little bit romantic, but it was what I was writing for 3 years was Room for a New Love. Okay, because I wanted to meet another lady. Okay, and in the third year, guess what? I finally ended up doing the long fourth and fifth step that I'd been postponing. And in 2 weeks, I met the woman that I'm married to today. Okay. And, you know, and in Alcoholics Anonymous, you can end up doing things that you wouldn't necessarily think you'd ever do otherwise. What was my first date with this female? It was to a memorial service. Okay? And it's actually a tragedy. A woman fell over dead at the age of 45 years old that had been married for maybe 2 months. Okay? And, you know, it was just so accumulated punishment from all the habits she had in some other fellowships. And, you know, and I can still remember it so well, is that you had the 13-year-old daughter there that was, you know, reading this nice little thing about how, you know, she knows that her mother is not going to be able to be with her on prom night. And, oh, geez. But what that got me an opportunity to do was put the arm around the female, because it was really very moving, and tears and all that. So after the ceremony, I figured it'd be a good idea to have my date go up and meet the female pastor who was in charge of the ceremony. Now, the female was married, the lady that I'm married to now, and she ends up meeting Don then. So we have a nice conversation, and Mary and I turn to go away, and Donna chirps up, and she says, "I do marriages too." Okay, she married us. Okay, in roughly a year from that time frame, and that turns out to be Mary's sponsor to this day. That was in my late 50s, okay, when I'm too old to have another relationship. Well, guess what? I was wrong about that too, okay? But in many regards, again, it's a lesson in finding that what we think we know, we're wrong about, you know? And actually, it can be a real joy to be wrong. What a surprise, you know, that happens to be, to be able to unlearn. And, you know, whether or not I've met a lady that came into this fellowship at the age of 13. I met another lady that came into this fellowship at the age of 81. So it figures is that if you're between the age of 13 and 81 when you come into the fellowship, Alcoholics Anonymous might work for you. You know, because, if we can somehow set aside what we think we know, in the 12 and 12, it uses that phrase, open mind, over and over again. And to me, the word game, it is a little bit of a word game. It really does take an open mind to recognize you don't have an open mind. I didn't even know what that meant. You know, it takes a while to be able to digest and be able to really open up. Because, again, when I say I'm a recovering butthead, I've got the butthead filters. They're all up here, you know. And healthy messages will come at me. Guess what? My filters make them bounce off. They can't get to me. And that's why sooner or later, if you keep on coming back, healthy messages will start to get to you, in spite of you, if you're like me. Okay, and then over time, we can start to hear, and we can start to listen, and there really is a music. There's a grace. There's a wonderful warmth here. There's a lot of love here. And what I had to realize, you see, in the end result, is I had been looking for love in all the wrong places. It's right here, and it's called Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the love. Well done. Julie's going to give out the chips.
Speaking of love,
thank you. I'm Julie. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, Gary. That was a delight. I dropped my film appreciation class, too. It was stupid. Just as stupid as yours, I'm sure. We have a chip system here at NAVA, at this meeting, to mark our time in the program. We have a white chip for coming back or coming in for the first time to try 24 hours worth of sobriety or coming back. Anyone? All right, we have a silver chip for 30 days. We have a red chip for 90 days. Anybody? Yellow chip for 6 months. Green chip for 9 months. This is the quietest crowd I've ever had. This is like not a funeral. All right. Blue chip. Anybody have a year?
I'm Frank Waters, and a recovered alcoholic. And I just wanted to hug her. This is 22 for me. And I didn't drink, and I kept coming to meetings. Basically, I didn't drink, and I didn't die. That's how I picked this up today. And as Hoyt would say, none of us get out of this alive. But it's the... And we don't. But it's the quality of the dash, you know, that the date you're born, the date you die, your whole life's a little dash. And what you want to fill it with is, you know, is what life's all about. And I want that dash to be more than what it used to be. And that and a lot of service work and do a lot of service work. I actually hide in service. I hide from Frank in service a lot, to where I don't have to deal with me and my issues a lot. So that can work for you and it can also work against you. Just don't drink in the meantime, and you'll figure it out sooner or later. Thank you.
Anybody else for you? I'll offer the white chip one more time. Anybody change your mind? All right, congratulations, Frank. Thank you.
Time for AA-related announcements or NAVA Club announcements. Yes, Frank.
Yeah, or Jack. Jack, ladies first.
I'm kind of an alcoholic. Yeah. Saturday night, this game, 11 p.m. is a night owl.
And for the next three Saturdays from 4 to 5 o'clock, I'll be there still giving dance lessons in there for free. So show up and enjoy yourself.
Cha cha cha. Next week. Oh, Bill W. will be here. And he insisted that we use his last name, so not to be confused with our founder. And then after that, Lynn S. Lynn S. put on our yard sale, NAVA yard sale, put a ton of work into it. So we're going to put her right back to work, and she's going to tell her story in 2 weeks from tonight. And if that's it, last chance on announcements. I remind you that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles for personalities, and for those who will, please join us. Please join hands in the Lord's Prayer.
Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever.
First I slept and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me and finally waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. For a heart that beats for me, takes me where the promises are real. See you.